Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. Today, we have a very special show lined up. We have Lawrence Lepard and Caitlin Long joining us today. But before we jump into the show, I want to give a very special shout out to the Bitcoin company that powers the show, the best place to build your Bitcoin stack, Swan Bitcoin. It's being built by Bitcoiners. It's for Bitcoiners. It's the best place to dollar cost average. Also, check out their new product. Bitcoin is generational wealth, and you can secure your bright orange future with the Swan IRA. Swan offers both traditional and Roth options to best fit your needs. This is real Bitcoin, not ETF or other derivative. Get the real thing and get it at Swan. Build your legacy your way. Go to swan.com/IRA for more details. And of course, if you have any questions, doubts, or concerns, you could always hit me up on Twitter DMs. All right, guys, no more delay. Let's do this.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Hey.
How's life? How are you, Caitlin?
Hey, doing great, thanks. How are you?
I don't know if you remember this, but I ran into you guys backstage at Bitcoin 2023, and I was like, they would be amazing on a pod together. Why don't we do that?
I do recall that, yeah.
So I chased Caitlin for a long time. I was like, Caitlin, please, come on Simply. She finally agreed. Awesome. Thank you so much. And then I approached Larry and I said, Larry, you want to come? And he said, of course.
You bet.
So happy to have you guys together. So a lot of things have been happening very, very quickly, whether that is, you know, the announcement by BlackRock, whether the ETF, the lawsuits against Coinbase, the lawsuits against Binance. So I feel like a lot of things have happened in the last month or two. And also, you know, the price of Bitcoin has been kind of going sideways. So, Caitlin, from your angle, what are your thoughts on this whole thing happening with BlackRock? We had a narrative back in 2018, and it was a coping narrative when Bitcoin hit 20K and it went back down. And it was the institutions are coming. So, Caitlin, my question to you is, are the institutions here? Is it finally happening?
I don't know, and I don't care that much. I'll tell you why. I've been consistent since that time. I started writing for Forbes back in 2018 saying, this is all a double-edged sword, including the spot ETF. Yeah. It's a double-edged sword because you're bringing the big Wall Street games, paper money games, to Bitcoin. And it's going to, if you pick up any ETF prospectus, you're going to see that the market makers have the ability for liquidity purposes to create more fund units than they have actual collateral in their proverbial vault. Okay, that's true for ETFs, for stocks, for commodities, and for Bitcoin. It's going to be true. Now, typically you don't see, say, more than 5% fake assets created that are not backed by one for one by the real thing, but they have the ability to do it. And once the ETF gets out there, then you start to get into all the hedge fund, collateral substitution games, right? And all of this ultimately ends in the same kind of market structure that has happened to physical commodities of limited quantity. And I know Larry's all over this issue as well.
Yep. Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. I haven't had a chance to read the BlackRock S1. Have you, Caitlin?
No, not in detail.
Yeah,
no.
I'd love to see what's in it. But yeah, it's a double-edged sword. It's the correct way to describe it. I mean, the good news is here's the biggest asset manager that said it was 3 years ago, said it was for money laundering, endorsing it. And of course, they only do that because they think they can make money on it. Not because they are pure of heart, but they can create paper Bitcoin. And somebody on Twitter said, "Oh no, this is great. You know, we'll be able to see their addresses and see when people buy." And then I said, "What makes you think they're going to tell you their addresses?
Correct.
No way you're going to know what they're doing." And this has paper Bitcoin written all over it. And I've been doing this for 30 years in gold GLD, and The good news is they're endorsing it and they'll bring more investors into the fold for sure, because now a lot of people who can't because of career risk say, hey, client, put some money into Bitcoin. Now they can. But the bad news is they'll get their claws on it and we're going to see more paper Bitcoin.
So one of the, and I'm just curious to get your guys' thoughts. And of course you have, you know, tremendous amount of experience, both you guys. Wouldn't you say that Bitcoin is slightly different though? Because, you know, you have gold's physical characteristics. So we know that this happened in the gold market. Larry and I, we've had this conversation before, right? We know in terms of what's happening with gold, but wouldn't you say that because of Bitcoin's physical characteristics, its ability for people to take self-custody of it, for you to just, you know, take it out easily, you know, without encumbering this crazy cost. Because if you try to do that with $100 million of the gold, then it's going to be a lot of security guards and a lot of big trucks. But you do that with Bitcoin, it's extremely cheap. So wouldn't you say, Caitlin, that there's a little bit of a check there in terms of them being able to do what they did with gold?
You're laying out really well the reason why Trace Mayer called Bitcoin the apex predator of finance. Because ultimately, when that proverbial run on all the institutions that created paper Bitcoin occurs, and it inevitably will, then you will see, as Buffett likes to say, who's swimming naked when the tide goes out. Okay. That's absolutely true. It's a lot easier for people to demand to take physical delivery of Bitcoin than it is for gold. Absolutely true. The challenge is that I don't think these spot ETFs allow the holder to convert to the physical. The choice that you have, and I could be wrong about this, but the choice that you have with these spot ETFs is to sell the ETF unit, not to convert to the underlying. And see, this is where the games get played, right? They try to trap people into thinking, and the same thing happened with the securities versions of gold, right? It did, no question, bring in more investors into the precious metals asset class when the ETF was created, no question, increased liquidity and temporarily increased price. But, you know, and again, Larry's been doing this for 30 years. There's no question in the minds of most of the people in that market that all the paper gold that got created, because the same thing was true with the gold ETFs, you could not redeem for physical. And your question is, even if you could redeem for physical, people couldn't physically take it. They don't have the vault set up. They don't have the security set up to transfer it. You're absolutely right. It's a lot easier with Bitcoin. However, folks get trapped in these securities versions thinking that they own the real thing. But if you cannot redeem for the real thing, oh boy, you don't own the real thing at all.
Yeah, it's not your coins. I mean, I believe there was some talk, and I haven't read the S1. I probably should have before this interview, but I believe there was some talk that certain very large people might be able to take the coins directly out of BlackRock, something like, I don't know, 40,000 units or something. I don't recall, but that's possible. But I mean, and frankly, that's true with GLD too. You can, at a certain size, you can ask for the gold. I don't think anybody ever does it, and the size is quite large. But to your point, you know, Nico, I think I know where you're going. You know, is it going to be as easy to manipulate Bitcoin as it is to manipulate gold is a question I get asked a lot. And I would say not quite, for a couple of reasons. One, because gold has been around a lot longer and they've built up all kinds of infrastructure to do it. So they've had 40 years to figure out how to do it, and they've done it really well. And, you know, Robert Rubin was a J. Aaron trader before he went to Goldman, and then he helped Clinton wreck the bond market. And so they've got a great system, and they did it all through the Cayman Islands. They had all these entities in the Cayman Islands that were, you know, buying and selling and shorting gold, and they had an unlimited balance sheet. I mean, I'm quite sure, I believe strongly, I don't know if Caitlin agrees with me on this, but I believe quite strongly that the government runs two sets of books, and that you know, they've had national security directive from the president about doing financial things kind of off the books. And I think that there were times when it was important where they would short gold or go long the S&P futures or do whatever they had to do. And if it turned out that trade, whatever hedge fund they had do that on their behalf, did not work out for them, they just printed the money and filled the hole. And it was all off balance sheet, off books. I mean, Catherine Austin Pitts talks about this too. So, you know, it's going to be harder to do this with Bitcoin. And one, the biggest reason I cite is the price volatility. You know, with gold, a big year is up 30% and a big down year is maybe down 15 or 20%. You know, look, you can short into that and hold it and wait. And then, you know, I mean, they can play that game. This is a whole different asset. This is a whole different animal. And, you know, Luke Roman and I have laughed about this a lot. I mean, when when Bitcoin went from 5 or 10 grand to 50 grand in the space of 12 months, that was a holy fucking shit moment for a lot of central bankers all over the world. I mean, they were like, oh my God, we got a real problem here. And so, you know, if you think about how they manipulated gold and they did it through the Caymans, you know, you're down 30% in a position, it's leveraged, whatever. You can do it. But when you've got something that can rip your face off to the tune of a 400% appreciation very quickly, that's an entirely different kettle of fish. So, you know, they're going to have to be careful. And, you know, to the question of, is it being manipulated today? You can go to Glassnode, you can look at the futures contracts, you can look at the number of derivatives outstanding. Caitlin knows this probably better than I do, but, and there are billions of dollars involved in, you know, playing around with paper Bitcoin. But if you look at, if you go to, you know, CoinMarketCap and you look at what's trading every day, and you look at the total market cap, it's still pretty small. I mean, the paper gold traded as against the underlying physical moving around, you know, there have been various computations done by some of the really smart people that show that it's, you know, 10 to 100x. And I don't think that's occurring yet with Bitcoin.
And what you're saying, Caitlin, is that you believe that this is inevitable. You believe that you think that this will happen in Bitcoin.
Well, it's not inevitable. And I don't have, back to Larry's point, I don't have evidence. And again, I'm not an expert in these gold markets of what the US government may or may not be doing. I'm not sure it's necessarily off books, because keep in mind, there's a gigantic other on the Fed's balance sheet. So, and derivatives are, as you know, they can have, I mean, hell, we've seen it in the Bitcoin markets, 125-to-1 leverage. Okay. Right. So it might not actually be very high in value, the derivatives that are being bandied about. And so you know, those, any kind of derivatives contracts, Lord knows what's in that other category. And I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but it was several hundred billion dollars last I looked, right? And that's, you know, I'm sure there's going to be the real estate that the Fed owns and all that, but there's more than just that in there. And people have been speculating for years, what are those other assets? And that is one of the places where large derivatives trades that could move markets, including shorting derivatives trades, may be hidden, because they're just not in they're not very valuable in dollar value. But you know, not that huge other assets line item isn't broken out. So, but back to your point, is this inevitable? It, you know, it's so interesting, because if you go back to Trace Mayer's 7 network effects of Bitcoin, the 6th one is financialization. And he and I had a big debate 7 or 8 years ago about whether that was a good thing for Bitcoin, because if this is exactly what we were debating. And is it a good thing that the big Wall Street balance sheets come in and start applying the games that work in a Wall Street context, where profits are privatized and losses are socialized, because the financial institution counterparties will get bailed out if they are too big to fail. And we saw too big to fail now includes, you know, some regional banks, right? And so the point is those games work when there's somebody backstopping. And you know, this gets into the whole question of, should these practices be banned, or should we just allow the sort of free banking version and let markets work? Here's the problem. This is where I started as a free banker and ultimately evolved into a Rothbardian for one simple reason, that free banking is never a zero-sum game. The moment that you start creating paper versions of anything, you're impacting the supply demand dynamic. And I did a big tweet thread, and we can dig it up and put it in the show notes, about what does that mean when you create artificial supply of something that goes to satisfy real demand. And I was reading Hayek when I wrote that tweet thread a couple of years ago, and Hayek made a really interesting point, which is that it's not just about pushing the supply curve out and to the right, which pushes the price down, right? Anytime you create an increased supply of something, whether it's artificial or real, all else equal, the price is going to go down because the supply curve moves out to the right. So the point at which it intersects the demand curve is lower, ergo the price is lower. But he pointed out that it actually influences demand for the real thing as well. And you get hit on a double whammy. And so that's ultimately why I don't agree with the free bankers. There is no free lunch. I think the one thing Rothbard was adamant about, it, which is that any kind of paper asset, i.e. a claim to an asset that's not backed one-to-one in real time with the actual asset, is going to have an influence on the price. It's going to suppress the price of the asset. It just is. And whether it's free bankers who are willing to temporarily allow situations like that to happen because they feel like the markets will self-correct. The problem is, if you're caught up in a situation like that in that moment, and the market hasn't self-corrected, you just got your pocket picked. And that's what's going to happen here. And it is happening. It is happening in spades, right? I mean, we saw it with FTX, where they had sold allegedly Bitcoin, but never actually bought the real Bitcoin. So there were claims to Bitcoins outstanding that were not backed by real Bitcoins. We saw it in Celsius, which admitted, and BlockFi, they both admitted that they rehypothecated. Again, that's one of those those Wall Street games that gets played, that, you know, it works and causes huge amounts of wealth to be diverted into the hands of people who control the wealth on Wall Street, because they're the first ones to get the printed money. I do believe that there's a Cantillon effect in that regard. And they, if they blow up, the worst thing that happens is they walk away and the taxpayer ultimately gets, you know, foots the bill. Yeah. For those of us who don't think that that is ethical, those kind of games should never happen. And that's what Rothbard was saying. And it was one of the few things that he thought that the government should do, which is to ban the fraudulent practice of invading property rights by creating more claims to your property than there is actual property.
Let me ask a question here, Nico, if I can. Let me just understand. You say, you know, I know it pushes the supply curve out, creating the fake supply. You said it pushes the demand curve as well. Is that based on perception? Is that how you're getting to the demand being affected? That therefore, because the price is low, people don't understand that it's going up, and therefore people say, "Oh, I'm going to give up on this asset," and therefore their demand goes away. Is that what you're?
Yeah, I wish I had that Hayek quote at hand, but that was one of those light bulb moments for me, and I ended up writing a big long tweet thread about it.
I thought that was what you meant. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, no, it's great, and again, we'll dig it up so the listeners can read it for themselves, because Hayek was brilliant. Hayek really truly understood all of these dynamics and also saw Bitcoin coming. I mean, his famous quote about how markets
subtly taken away from them,
create a way to go around them. Exactly,
a sly roundabout way. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Go ahead, Larry.
Let me just build on Caitlin's point.
And just to be clear, by the way, I put you guys both together so you guys could do 99% of the talking, and I could just
I know you've got a question you're burning to ask, but I just want to comment on Caitlin's thing. You know, what she's alluded to is when you can spoof markets, when you can create paper, when you have a derivatives, quote unquote, market, you can manipulate the price of things, okay? I mean, you can set the price anywhere you want, because a derivatives game effectively becomes a balance sheet game. And it's like being at table stakes poker, where, you know, there's a table limit. And if you knew you had all the money and you could make a bet and nobody else could call you, you'd win by definition. And so that kind of thing is what happens in these derivatives markets. And it's why I strongly believe, I think Caitlin probably shares my view on this, that when Bitcoiners rule the world, and there's no doubt in my mind that one day we will, we need to ban and outlaw financial derivatives, just as Caitlin has talked about. There cannot be any paper. I mean, the derivatives were originally created, futures were originally created to allow a grower of corn and a user of corn to, you know, hedge out their risk and arrive at a price that would allow each to do what was right for their business. But of course, we've gone way beyond that. And, and now we see multiples and multiples of the underlying corn, you know, being quote unquote bet on in a casino like fashion, where the people with the biggest balance sheet win and the government has the biggest balance sheet. I mean, this is how Robert Rubin manipulated the gold price. I mean, remember, you know, Caitlin will remember this. James Carville said, "I want to come back as the bond market because I can scare the shit out of everybody." And, and they knew, you know, Clinton wanted a better economy in order to get elected. And he knew that the only way he was going to get that was if he printed money, he was fiscally aggressive, and he got the economy rolling. And he was like, "How the hell am I going to do that without having inflation take off?" And Rubin said, "No problem. You know, gold is the canary and we'll shoot it." So, you know, we've got to outlaw derivatives, but that's multiple steps down the road. You know, we got to win first.
Well, this is interesting, Larry, because I think we found a place where you and I disagree. It's not going to end up being a huge difference. But where I'm willing to go is futures contracts that have no leverage are fine and that settle in the physical underlying.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because a lot of people will assume that folks like us are anti-debt. Absolutely, we're not anti-debt.
Right.
We're anti-circulation credit, but right. pro-commodity credit. That's absolutely. The difference.
No, the producer of corn and the buyer of corn should be able to hedge out that risk.
Correct.
Right. It's the gambling and the derivatives on top of that that distort the price signals and cost us all money.
And right now you can do 2.5-to-1 leverage, give or take, on the domestic cash settled Bitcoin futures contracts.
Right.
So that's a lot better than the 125-to-1 leverage that offshore markets will provide. In other words, a lot lower, but it's still too high, you and I would argue, because the miners ultimately, I mean, we're seeing this happening in Bitcoin mining. The miners are interested in hedging their production, and the futures markets are the things that give them the ability to do that. What you don't want is the mining companies to then become trading firms, right? And this is, once they become trading firms, you know, the incentive to basically become a hedge fund is very, very high. And the right. tools exist for Bitcoin miners to become hedge funds, where they're just basically trading these financial contracts back and forth. That's right. not what we want. We want the miners to be able to have price certainty by selling forward their production, 3 months from now. But if it's physically settled and it's not leveraged, then I think that financial instrument becomes very useful and helps take some of the volatility and the risk, which translates into the cost of capital for the Bitcoin miners. And that's a good thing for the industry, getting the whole industry's cost of capital down. That's a good thing. But I think we're not saying something different. It's so interesting. You and I point this out to each other that yes. there's a perception that we stand for all leverage being bad. Absolutely not.
No, not at all.
You need credit in the economy. It's just yes. that it should come from prior savings rather Correct. Than from thin air. And that's Correct. The difference between commodity credit and circulation
actually,
credit.
Also, having said that too, I think a Bitcoin standard economy, credit and debt are going to be much less prevalent. I mean, I think that, you know, it's going to be financed the way the 1800s were financed, which is really equity capital.
Correct.
Savings and equity capital. People are going to look forward to getting dividends. You know, not
well, the US economy was equity financed up until 1968. And what I mean by that was, if you look at the cumulative savings, you get the NYPA data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and just look at the cumulative savings in the US economy and compare it to non-financial debt. Uh-huh. Each year, those two things roughly offset. One year, maybe one was a little ahead. The other was, next year, the other was a little ahead. But they were pretty much two straight lines. So in other words, we actually did, up until 1968, what you and I were just talking about, which is have an equity-financed economy. And right. then something happened in 1968 and things went haywire ever since. A lot of folks point to 1971 as the trigger, which is when Nixon went off the gold standard officially, the last vestige of it. But what you see in the data is that the U.S. was under pressure 3 years before that
because
non-financial debt started going up for the guns and butter program.
Very much so. And that's why the gold drained from 20,000 tons down to 8,300. And by the way, a lot of people don't know this. Everyone says the reference price of gold in 1971 was $35. No, it wasn't. It was trading at $60 or $70 in London. So the peg had already been broken.
Right.
What Nixon did was just recognize the fact that the world was calling the bluff on the U.S. fiscal situation.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, Kaylin, you said something and you said it as well, Gary, about this concept of outlawing derivatives, right? Outlawing this type of stuff that could hurt. And the Bitcoiner in me, the libertarian in me is like, wouldn't you just want the free market to figure it out? And the reason that I truly believe that I think it can is because of look what happened with Celsius. Look what happened with FTX. I know what the other response is, like, Nico, look at how many people got hurt and whatever. But at the end of the day, it did flush itself out by itself.
Yes.
There was no, lender of last resort. It returned to the status quo. Nature healed itself. And of course, I felt like that was so bad Bitcoiners saying this while all these people were losing, their life savings. But at the end of the day, You know, if you just stayed humble, stack sats, you just bought Bitcoin, you took it into self-custody, you're just watching from the sidelines. I just get very hesitant when we ask for more government regulation, because there's history has shown that there's always unintended consequences to more regulation. So I, of course, you guys have so much more experience than I have. I just want to get your guys' thoughts on that.
No, you just articulated the free bankers concept very well, which is that markets work. We had the flush. Anybody who rolled the dice, chasing yield with those companies that were paying, you know, 20% yields, but they probably should have been paying 200% yields to compensate people for their for the credit risk, right? You just articulated really well. But here's the thing. What was the unseen impact of that? And that's where the real impact is. It was, I would say, three things. Number one, it put a cap on the top of the price appreciation. Because if we had a true free market, I do believe the stock to flow model would have worked better. Number two, it caused us to break through the trend of higher highs and higher lows. We actually had a lower low because we broke through the previous high. And number three, it distorted the cost of capital for the entire Bitcoin industry because of number one and number two, right? We had the top clipped off the market because of the price suppression. We had the bottom pierced because of the higher volatility, and the higher volatility as a result of the, you know, just the to use the Hoover quote, you know, the cannonballs on the deck of a ship in a tempest-tossed era, money was just sloshing all over the place, right? What did that do? It increased the cost of capital to everyone. So this is the, who was the New York Times? Hazlitt wrote the book that made everyone think about the subtle consequences that you don't necessarily see in looking at a market price. And I think that that's the cost. This is where I disagree. Again, I started as a free banker, exactly the way you articulated it, thinking let's let the markets flush. But the problem is that it's not a zero-sum game. If it were, I would be right with you. The problem is it does actually have real-world cost. And those costs, unfortunately, increase the cost of capital for everybody.
I think I can bridge the gap between your two positions. So, Nico, I think when we get to a completely decentralized society where there aren't as many big and powerful institutions who can play this game and wreak the havoc that Caitlin is talking about, then free banking works. But I think that as long as you have the federal government as they are, and you have the BlackRocks of the world, and you have all this centralization of power and the potential for the abuse of that centralization, then I want to have laws that say they can't do it. You follow me?
I 100% follow you. And it actually, it reminds me of this tweet, and you know, when you say something on Twitter and it pops off, you know, you've resonated with a lot of people, you know, that a lot of people are putting the same amount of thought into this. And the tweet was this: it's not winning that worries me. It's the transition. The transition from a non-Bitcoin standard to a Bitcoin standard. To go back to your point, Larry, then maybe, you know, these imperfect laws are what's going to have to be necessary in order to push forward this Bitcoin standard. I'm really, really enjoying this conversation. And Caitlin, I don't know if you wanted to add to that, because I know you got excited when I say when I said my bit about the transition.
Well, Safi Dean and I recorded a podcast probably 2 years ago on this very topic. Is this unstable dollar system that we all, if we're honest, recognize is fundamentally unstable, right? We saw some of the instability with the bank failures in March. The Fed was able to expand its balance sheet and tamp that down temporarily. We're going to just keep seeing those because we all understand that it's all a confidence game, right? That, you know, our banks take our money in and turn around and lend long term. And we all think we can all get our money out at the same time. And if we all happen to show up at the same time, then that bank, the insolvency of that bank is revealed. Okay. So fundamentally, I don't think it's controversial to say that the US dollar system is not resting on stable foundations. It never has. And a lot of folks are just waking up to realize that. Okay, so now if you grant that, would you rather live in a world that goes to hyper Bitcoinization very fast? Or would you rather live in a world where the system ends with a whimper, not a bang? If we live in a world where the dollar system collapses very fast, unfortunately, I think we're looking at some pretty serious instability in society.
And bans, right? Too.
Whereas
I think they'll fully 6102 order. If we have, you know, they'll try everything and anything.
Well, sure.
At that point.
You should expect that. And think through that in your own, as you think about the attack vectors on your own Bitcoin and self-custody, right? What, you know, how would they be able to get it from you if there is another executive order like that? But now we're into the whole, what's the likelier outcome? And Saifedean and I ultimately agreed, not only is it better that it ends with a whimper, not a bang, with people just voting with their feet to go to the mm-hmm. new, better world, but it's more likely that that's going to be the case because the central banks are just going to keep expanding their balance sheets every time there's a financial crisis. And, you know, eventually there's something like, last I looked, $95 trillion of non-financial sector debt outstanding in the United States. Fed's balance sheet topped off, give or take, $10 trillion. Okay, so we kind of know where the end game is going to be. It's when all $95 trillion of the non-financial sector debt gets monetized. It's going to happen before then, well before then, where the world wakes up and realizes the dollar, you know, is built on a foundation of sand. But I think we have a ways to go. And I don't want to live through a world of financial instability, which is why I actually care a lot. And I think Larry does agree with this, about how the transition takes place. And that's why Custodia did what it did. Do you think I'm having fun dealing with the Fed? well, actually now I am, but for a while there, I didn't, let's put it that way.
Go ahead, Larry.
No, go ahead. That, well said.
What I've noticed, right, is we're all kind of fighting for the same thing, but we're all using our own unique talents, our unique experiences, and our unique vantage points to kind of push it forward. Right.
Sure.
Larry is a macro heavyweight of Bitcoin Twitter. And, you know, he's a very well respected mind in the space. And, you know, I look up to him as a mentor sometimes and on the things that he has to say.
Nice.
And Kaylin, you're pushing forward the first, Bitcoin bank. And the powers that be literally moving the goalpost to, because I've been covering.
Oh, many times. Wait till the whole story comes out. It's not going to shock folks, you know, in the Bitcoin community, but the rest of the world's going to be like, what? How corrupt is this process?
It's nuts. And I have a daily Bitcoin show, so I have to keep in daily Bitcoin news. So I've been keeping up with the process. And it's at first, it's like, what did they say at first? It takes 2 to 3 weeks to go through the approval. And then
5 to 7 days.
And then they pushed it back. And then they waited for the blow up to basically deny you and say no, you know. So it was all so, you know, clearly, they're not playing by the same set of rules that everyone else is. And then this goes back to a very important question for you, Kaylin, and it applies to you mostly, which is, I think the people that have the most to lose if Bitcoin succeeds, are also the people that are tasked to regulate this thing. What would you say about that statement?
I think that's right. But if they, it's like the taxi and limousine commissions with Uber, right? Their first instinct is protect the incumbents because the incumbents are their friends. And there's a revolving door, clearly, where even Fed governors are in revolving door situations where they leave the Fed and, you know, go join a bank board. And, you know, this is, I'm alluding to both the former Fed Vice Chair for Supervision, Randy Quarles, starting an uninsured 100% reserve non-lending bank in Connecticut 8 months after he left the Fed. And then also Sarah Bloom Raskin, who was a Fed governor, who joined the board of Reserve Trust and allegedly helped Reserve Trust get a master account, even though it didn't appear to be eligible. We now know, thanks to the Fed's master account database, that there are 414 uninsured institutions that have Fed master accounts So the Fed was clearly applying a double standard when it was complaining that Custodia was not insured. And of course, one of their buddies just went and started one of those uninsured banks that has applied for a master account. But we also, on top of that, know that there are powerful incumbents who have master accounts that do not appear to be eligible for them. Okay, so the Fed's just simply not following the law. Period. That's objectively true. So you know, we'll see. It's back to your question though about are these the folks that are the most threatened by it? Sure, but if you think about the taxi and limousine commissions, right? Their first instinct was to protect their buddies and to block change, but then the change overwhelmed them, and that's where Custodia comes in. The change is going to overwhelm them. There was an internal estimate of how much bank deposit withdrawals took place during the last Bitcoin bull market. And it was, I believe, $850 billion. Okay. Now, on an $18 trillion deposit base, that's not that much. Banks keep anywhere from 7 to 10 cents in cash on their balance sheets. So the banking system could absorb a withdrawal like that. But what's it going to be in the next bull market? That's the real question. And I actually think it's going to be a lot bigger than it was last time.
Yeah.
In part because the instability of the traditional system is a lot better known and understood, right? We just had the proverbial Twitter bank run. So anybody who's watching social media now has a better understanding that their bank might not be stable. And you know, this is where I do think you can't paint the banking system with the same broad brush. There are banks who absolutely understand and respect this. And thank God there are banks who do understand and respect this and are willing to take the regulatory heat to serve this industry where the bank regulators would rather shove it into the shadows. And that's a wonderful thing. Thank goodness they're willing to do that, because it's keeping the parts of the US industry that haven't left the United States yet, it's keeping them alive for the next bull run. But in that next bull run, that's when I think the bank regulators will rue the day that they made a very short-sighted decision to try to shove this entire industry offshore and into the shadows, because they will be playing whack-a-mole with problems that will pop up in unexpected places in the banking system. And exhibit A for what happened the last time that is going to keep happening again and again was this Moonstone Bank thing, where Alameda, FTX's hedge fund affiliate, acquired a controlling stake in a existing FDIC-insured bank without applying to the Fed for a change in control. And if you read the change in control rules, once they took over, I believe it was more than 25% of the equity of the bank, they had to notify the Fed and get approval. They took over something like 83% of the equity of Moonstone Bank, didn't notify the Fed, didn't get approval, and it slipped through. Okay, wow. That kind of stuff is going to be happening in spades again. And this is where the Fed will rue the day that friendlies, we were a friendly at one time, literally trying to help them. And look what they did to us.
Yeah.
They got lucky on Moonstone just because it was small, right?
Yeah.
Well, I know of five similar kind of things in the works right now, where people have told me that they're doing what's called charter strip acquisitions of existing small banks and trying to slip them through and hope the regulators don't notice. But frankly, the regulators sent a hell of a message by the way they treated us, right? We were willing to comply at Custodia with every rule that applied to them. We even applied to become a Fed member bank, which would have been directly regulated by the Fed. And look what the Fed did. They in the denial, I laugh at it now, but it was 41 times longer than the longest ever denial in Fed history. And they literally threw the book at us, refused to correct factual inaccuracies. You know, that made me more angry at the time than it did now, because now I sit back and look at it going, man, did the Fed ever make a mistake in not letting Custodia in, because they now have another lawsuit from a non-crypto bank, and there are undoubtedly going to be more coming. The seal is broken. And so just like the SEC ended up having a federal judge make the decision, over the case that the SEC thought was a sure thing, which is XRP. Is XRP a security? Well, a federal judge didn't deem that XRP is a security all the time. Guess what? That decision clipped the wings of the jurisdiction of the SEC. Well, you know, now there are multiple lawsuits over this same issue with the Fed, and I suspect more will be coming.
Wow. Yeah, and then also like the, and I want to kind of go back to the unintended consequences of this hostile regulatory environment, right? I remember very vividly, Jack Maulers did a speech at the Bitcoin Policy Summit in DC. Shout out David Zell with the Bitcoin Policy Institute. And he was very, very straight up with the regulators. He warned them twice. He said, guys, if you don't get your act together, right, I'm going to move. And then he said something very striking. He says, you want Bitcoiners paying taxes in Texas. You don't want them paying taxes in Dubai. And then if you take a look at what the CCP is doing, they're playing both sides. They're using Hong Kong as a test bed to benefit from NGU technology. But at the same time, in the mainland, you know, they could still have their, you know, their CBDC, you know, tight capital controls, et cetera, et cetera. So you can even make the argument that one of the United States' biggest opponents, you know, economically is literally saying, hey, guys, come here, you know, come here, do business here in Hong Kong. And you can't do business in Hong Kong without Beijing's approval. You know, so I do believe I agree with you. I think U.S. regulators are playing with fire completely.
They are.
But I'm also very optimistic. And to kind of go back to the taxi and the limousine medallion thing that you were talking about earlier, Caitlin, there's a non-zero chance that we might have a pro Bitcoin president in the White House.
Yes.
On the Republican side, we have Ron DeSantis. And on the Democratic side, we have RFK Jr., which has literally gone out to say at the Bitcoin conference, I will protect your right to self-custody, all that stuff, right?
Yep. So, and he went even further at Freedom Fest last week in Tennessee.
Oh, please let us know. I wasn't there. What did he say?
Oh, he I read a summary of it that he would usher in hyper-Bitcoinization. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I don't know if you use that word, but I'll also throw out, it's not just the two candidates in each political party that are polling second right now in the polls. There are also candidates on the Republican side, Vivek Ramaswamy, Francis Suarez, right, that are pro-Bitcoin. It's so interesting. I haven't seen Tim Scott come out yet, and he's in an interesting position because he's the ranking member of the Senate Banking Committee, which may ultimately be forced to take regulatory action. I actually think that the impact of the XRP decision, SEC versus Ripple, is going to increase the probability that legislation moves before the end of the Biden presidency, because it just absolutely threw into further disarray the U.S. crypto regulatory question. Right. Because now the SEC had its wings clipped by a federal judge, which it clearly didn't expect to do. You rarely see federal agencies undertake bet the farm litigation like that, where they hand the judicial branch a decision over the extent of their jurisdiction. The SEC took that gamble and lost. OK, but now what does that mean? It probably does mean that Congress, there's a higher probability that Congress acts. I don't know that it's 50-50 yet. But it's getting there. And Senator Tim Scott, who's, of course, running for president, is the ranking Republican on Senate banking. So he's going to have to be involved. I have not seen him take a stance yet on Bitcoin, but there are people around him who are pro-Bitcoiners. And by the way, I just talked to somebody last week. There are more pro-Bitcoiners around Trump this time as well. I don't think Trump understood when he put out his tweet, and I did. I answered him back in, it was probably 2019, 2020, because Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, is not pro-Bitcoin, but people around him are, people like Brian Brooks, for example, very pro-Bitcoin, right? So Mnuchin's got some people around him who are pro-Bitcoin. But Trump was listening to Mnuchin in being anti-Bitcoin. And that tweet thread I responded to, he was on Twitter. And it got a lot of engagement from people saying, hey, you really ought to sit down and listen to the Bitcoiners, because you're raging against the deep state, so to speak, And you have more in common than you realize with the Bitcoiners. So the funny thing is, I think there are some folks, I know there are some folks around Trump, because what's funny is people have been reaching out to me. And so I'm hearing from the different campaigns that, you know, there are more pro-Bitcoiners than you think. Do not be shocked. I'm not predicting it, because Trump is certainly on the record as being very, very anti-Bitcoin. But I think that that ice may be thawing.
Yeah. And just to go ahead, Larry, hit it.
Let me ask Caitlin a question, because just go back to different. Caitlin, you and I have discussed in the past, you've given me some clue into it, but I think a lot of the listeners would be very interested to know kind of, you know, so the Fed really shut you down in terms of getting your license. Can you just talk a little bit, take us through the politics of that and how that happened and what you think? I know you kind of got the inside baseball on what was going down, and I'd be very curious to hear, I think the listeners would too, to hear kind of how you got shut down. And, you know, was it Jamie Dimon? Was it Powell? Was it Biden? You know, what was the genesis of your denial?
Well, we do know the White House was involved. That is publicly disclosed. Right. And you could see it from the fact that the Fed's denial of Custodia was announced at the same time as an anti-crypto policy by the Fed.
Right.
And coordinated with a statement from the National Economic Council at the White House, all mm-hmm. released at the same time. And then Custodia's master account was denied exactly 2.5 hours later. This is all military precision timing. Right. It was denied by the Kansas City Fed. These entities are supposedly independent, right? The Fed is supposed to be independent mm-hmm. of the White House. The Kansas City Fed alleges that it's independent of the board of directors on such decisions, but it clearly was not. And I am not just saying that by pointing to the timing coincidence. I'm saying that because we had insiders tell us what was going on, and the name of the person at the White House. I'd never met this person. I have no idea how he knew who Custodia was. But when I looked him up, guess what? He's very connected to Elizabeth Warren. So, you know, shooting the proverbial, stallion to scatter the herd was seemingly the strategy. And that's all I can say. I do know more. But I want to thank the folks who did come forward, because there were pro-crypto people in the Biden White House who were appalled by what happened to Custodia. And yes, there is a lot more. But as you know, the end of the story has not been written yet.
Right.
There's some really great things happening to Custodia right now. Like I said, I'm having fun.
Yeah. I mean, they don't call this the peaceful revolution for no reason. Right. And I'm going to go back to what I was saying, that I think each one of us on this podcast right now are playing a role. I'm more in the trenches, battleground of the internet media warfare. Caitlin, you're in the banking warfare. And then Larry's in the trench right next to me as well.
With the money management. Yeah, but his money management business is a big part of this as well, for sure.
Absolutely.
Of course.
It's been rough.
and you're also investing in Bitcoin companies, right? So
very much so.
Yeah.
Well, we're an investor. My fund is an investor with Caitlin and Custodia. We've done all the rounds and a huge supporter. We've also invested in Jeff Booth's Ego Death and then 1031. We're Bitcoin only in our focus. We haven't done any other crypto. I'm very much a believer that everything else is a shitcoin. So, yeah.
What would you say to that, Caitlin?
I'm a long-term maxi. This is how I've described this. So here's where I do believe that every technology has a right to exist, as long as it's not defrauding people. Now, that's where people start to get into the shades of gray. But I do believe the other technologies have the right to exist and the right to compete. I don't think anybody can say with certainty, because nobody is a soothsayer, nobody knows the future. We can't say with certainty that Bitcoin is going to be the survivor. I think it is the likeliest survivor. I don't see anything at this point that is going to challenge its role as money. But there are other technologies that I do believe have the right to exist. That said, you know, you see me with the Bitcoin t-shirt and the Bitcoin mug. We did publicly disclose that Custodia has filed required advance notice with our regulator to launch Bitcoin custody. We will be launching Bitcoin custody soon, subject to regulatory approval. We don't have a date on that yet. But it's going, when we do, we're bringing a legal and regulatory regime that truly respects Satoshi's ethos, which is we respect property rights. Now, the difference here is I believe in not your keys, not your coins. The split that Custodia and indeed the other Wyoming Speedy banks are making, because this is the law that applies to the special purpose banks in Wyoming that are designed for Bitcoin custody, is that we will provide the service of managing the private key, but you keep title to your asset. That's the law of bailment. You've probably heard me talk about this before. It's the same law as valet parking for your car or a coat check. You're not giving the service provider, the safekeeper, in other words, title to your property. You still own your car. You still own your property. And if it's stolen, it's your homeowner's insurance that pays for your coat or your auto insurance that pays for your car. It's not the garage itself or the restaurant that pays for it. What would happen in the insurance world is your policy that insures your property pays for the loss, and then your insurance company will go after the restaurant or the garage's insurance company if there was negligence, for example. So that's the way it works. It is a different model. And here again, I think one of the things that is challenging, and here, let me make a Bitcoin maxi argument for one of the reasons that you don't want to go into a custodian that is all things to all people and provides all the proverbial shitcoin custody services. Here's why. We saw it in Celsius. In Celsius, the judge in the Chapter 11 bankruptcy created what's called a constructive bailment. The judge said, yep, the custody customers, not the earned customers, the custody customers owned those assets. But because it was all done within the same legal entity as the earned product, the judge would not let the custody customers take their money. Why? Because in Chapter 11, there was the threat of clawbacks and preferences. Okay. In Chapter 11, that there is always going to be that threat. So what does that mean, practically speaking? And I've had this very conversation with a wealthy Bitcoiner. If you're holding your Bitcoin at a custodian that is, you know, adding the latest shitcoin protocol to its custody services, and let's say that that latest shitcoin protocol has a zero-day exploit, and now the custodian just went bust, what's going to happen? You're thinking, well, gosh, the Bitcoin's fine, and that's true. And you go to a Chapter 11 bankruptcy judge and you say, hey, those Bitcoins are mine. And the judge says, yes, as they did in Celsius. But then the judge says, there might be preferences and clawbacks. Mm-hmm. You can't have your assets now. And guess what ended up happening? The custody customers of Celsius agreed voluntarily to settle for a 27.5% haircut just to get their money out now and not have to be, you know, fighting for years over the clawbacks and the preferences. Now, why is the Wyoming Speedy Bank structure better? Because a bank cannot be dragged into federal bankruptcy court. And the receivership rules for a bank as a legal entity, as custodian, favor the customers. Okay, so if you create a very clear statutory bailment and the custodian is not trying to be all things to all people, so you don't have that left field operational risk of some shitcoin protocol collapsing that brings your custodian down, and you've got a clear receivership regime that allows you, even if the judge freezes your assets, you can run to a court and say, hey, those assets are mine, give them to me now. It's a much friendlier customer regime, and one that is, I think, a lot closer to what Satoshi created with Bitcoin, where you have clarity of property rights. Good fences make good neighbors.
Gotcha. I mean, and I'll say this, Caitlin, because I'm debating whether I'll talk about myself individual on an individual basis. Once you get, you need to start holding Bitcoin and it starts becoming, you know, a large portion of your life savings and whatnot, the custody solutions become very technical. Obviously, right. I don't mind geographically separating multi-sig, and I could do that with my eyes closed, but I've also been here for 8 years, right? Yeah. My mom, who's also has that setup, If I ask her to send me a Bitcoin transaction from that multi-sig cold storage, she will have absolutely no idea how to do that, right? Even though she has some pretty badass cold storage. So I'm going to use that word that we use earlier on in the conversation. I do believe that during the transition, I do believe that custodians, a lot of people are going to prefer custodians. And do you yes. see that's where Custodia, I mean, it's in the name, I guess. Do you see where Custodia, that's where it's going to play a big part, I guess.
Yes, but I'm still adamant, not your keys, not your coins, just like Jesse Powell, who also set up a Wyoming Speedy Bank. We both tell everyone, teach yourself self-custody. You're better off learning how to custody this yourself. What Custodia is building is for clients like Larry, asset managers, and even fiduciaries who actually in ERISA, which is corporate pension plans, there's personal liability for the fiduciaries. They have to make a judgment call on what's the best custody arrangement. And by law, they cannot both manage and custody the assets. That's the 1940 Investment Advisors Act and then the Investment Company Act that separated the two functions. The management of the assets have to be done by a different, unrelated legal entity at arm's length than the custodian of the assets. Okay, so what Custodia is building for is those long-only investors, the long-term hodlers who have to, by law, have a custodian. That's the primary audience, the primary target for the potential customers of custody for Custodia. But let me turn it over to Larry because he knows that institutional market much better than I do. He's in it.
Yeah. So I will be Caitlin's first customer because my fund owns a bunch of coins and I'm not going to say who, cause I'm kind of ashamed of it, but they are in cold storage at another firm. And that firm has brokerage and other operations. And of all the choices out there, I think we've done as much due diligence. I feel like this is as good as any, but honestly, I don't think it's as good as Caitlin. And so we will pay a fee to have Caitlin custody our coins. And exactly, I mean, and we could, you know, I cold storage my own coins, you know, not multi-sig, just, but, you know, and in theory, we could do that for my firm's coins, you know, the fund that I manage for the coin, but we couldn't, as she points out, it would be illegal to do that. So Caitlin needs to exist and firms need to exist. And to my way of seeing it, the ones that are the cleanest are the ones I want to be in. I want to be in firms that are Bitcoiners. They're only doing this. They don't have any other shit coins. I know the legal structure. In this case, it's in Wyoming. I love the bailment laws and what she's done there. I mean, she's the one who changed all these laws over the years. So to us, this is a perfect solution that we will pay handsomely to have. And I think others will too. I mean, I think other institutional money managers have the exact same problem I have. Lots of them. So.
Yeah. And Caitlin, could you describe to everyone, because I don't think people are familiar with that law. There's a reason that law was put in place, because there's a bit of a moral hazard, right, if that law wasn't in place. So could you give a little bit of a background of why you think that law is necessary and what are the benefits?
Well, first of all, we started with the reality that Bitcoin is a bearer instrument. Okay. And the way custody works in securities is very different, because the legal title is owned by the depository trust company. Most people don't understand that. 99.999% of the securities outstanding to publicly trade in the United States are owned by the same legal entity. It's called a central securities depository. And just for ease of paperwork, again, you know, we don't need to have this market structure, but it's a lot of people are making a lot of money off that old market structure, so they don't really want it to change. But for ease of paperwork, the depository trust company holds legal title to your securities. And what you have from your broker, your Charles Schwab or Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch, is an IOU for those securities. And the law doesn't actually require them to hold one-for-one securities. They can sell you. Remember what FTX did. FTX was selling you Bitcoin and they weren't buying the actual Bitcoin. That actually is true. It's very small amounts. There are fault tolerances allowing failure to deliver the actual securities in the securities market, because the infrastructure is so old, and the systems don't update at the same time. And you know, probably in the last 5 to 10 years, the systems could be updating in real time, but they didn't upgrade to real time systems. for a whole host of reasons, one of which was a lot of people are making a lot of money off the float and the ability to be naked short and things like that for brief periods of time. So it's really important that, that Wyoming said, wait a minute, we don't have to do custody that way where every client is in a debtor-creditor relationship, just like you are with Merrill Lynch or Schwab for your securities account. You're in a debtor-creditor relationship, whether you know it or not. We can go back to recognizing that this is a bearer instrument and create custody that, that allows you to keep the property rights. So you don't have this third party that legally owns title. That changes the structure. It puts some of the responsibility on the custody customer, just like with your car, you have to insure your car. And the insurance market is developing. But you're going to see custody, you're going to see Custodia offering insurance, private insurance, more than we will offer as a company. There will be an ability for the customers to buy up additional insurance if they want it. And it's in that way, you know, if just like you, if you have a sports car, you don't have to insure 100% of the value. You can self-insure some of it. You make the judgment call. Is it worth it to pay the price to insure versus not? And what's interesting is the insurance market at the moment for Bitcoin has not distinguished whether the custodian owns title to the asset or is merely in a debtor-creditor relationship just safeguarding the coins. But I think that will evolve over time. That's my prediction, that those that actually really are doing true custody, the way the old gold repositories, which ultimately evolved into banks in the 1800s, you know, some of the gold repositories were honest, not all of them were. And the dishonest ones collapsed. And, you know, at the end of the day, is the most important thing in my mind is what's the philosophy of the management team? Because the management team could be committed to 100% backing and not playing these financialization leverage games that we just talked about under the current law. But most of them don't. Most of them, as we saw, we just saw this in Prime Trust. I debated the CEO of BitGo, Mike Belsha, last week, and you know, pointed out some of the things in Prime Trust's customer agreement. They were allowed to rehypothecate customers' fiat currency assets. And so that meant, by definition, anytime the word rehypothecation is there, you're in a debtor-creditor relationship. Okay. And so if the company goes down, then assets are going to be deemed to belong to the bankruptcy estate. It's not a bailment. And therefore, the custody customers were going to take a haircut. But even on the digital asset custody, they had a line in their agreement that was not customer friendly. And it said, for Prime Trust's convenience, Prime Trust may keep title to the digital assets in Prime Trust's own name. And that doesn't necessarily destroy the bailment, but I saw the look on your face, Larry. Yeah. I mean, it clouds it. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
Right. No. If you are somebody who truly is there to serve your customers, as opposed to looking at your customers as a pincushion, as a means by which you can make profits.
Yeah.
There's a difference. There's a big difference in philosophy. And those that sign up for the Wyoming Special Purpose Depository Institution laws, where the bank is prohibited from lending the US dollar deposits and prohibited from rehypothecating customers' digital assets, even if the customer wants the bank to rehypothecate. The bank is by law prohibited. Anybody who signs up for those kind of restrictions is going to be philosophically committed to putting the customer first, I believe.
This is interesting territory. This is an interesting conversation. This is all, you know, this all happening so quickly. And really, I think it comes down to kind of Bitcoin being introduced to the mix and the legacy system not being properly set up to handle that, right?
Yeah.
But I think I kind of want to boil down to, because we're at the top of the hour and I want to be respectful of your guys' time. It all kind of boils down to not your keys, not your Bitcoin. Learn how to take self-custody. I think that in the vast majority of cases, I think that could be done. But to use that word that we used earlier, during the transition, I believe that, you know, using a custodian, whether for legal reasons or for someone who's not, doesn't have the technical know-how, I think, you know, that's That's what they're going to feel more comfortable with at the end of the day. So, Larry and Caitlin, I want to thank you guys so much for your time. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. It was an honor to have you guys both on at the same time and kind of bounce questions off each other. So, Caitlin, thank you. And why don't you tell everybody what you're working on these days? What's on your mind?
Hey, stay tuned, Custodia. Like I said, I've got a big, big smile on my face. Stay tuned.
That makes me happy, Caitlin.
I can't announce anything just yet, but look, we're having fun. We're having a lot of fun, and hopefully doing well by doing right by our customers and prospective customers. So stay tuned. But that's we will survive. We will be launching a bank to service the digital assets industry. And I want to say thank you to the partners who recognize the value of this technology, recognize that it's not going away. And frankly, did so much review of Custodia in part because of what the Fed did. That somebody laughed the other day about it's like the Monty Python scene where the guy loses his arm and oh, it's just a flesh wound, and then loses his other arm, and you know, then loses both legs, right? Yeah, it hurt what the Fed did to us, but we survived it, and we're coming roaring back in a wonderful way to help serve the right type of customer in this industry. We are not here for the low time preference, quick buck, quick flip kind of customer. We're here for folks like Larry who are committed to this technology, and that's who our partners are as well. And they understand and recognize that, and thank goodness for them.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Caitlin, and Larry, same to you. What's on top? What are you working on these days? And again,
wrapping up my quarterly report, which will be out soon. It'll be on Twitter. As you guys know, I make a lot of noise on Twitter. I'm not a fan of the central bankers, who I think are kind of the scourge of our generation or our time. And, I'm just trying to make money for my investors, which, it's interesting to me. One thing I will say, it's a very bright spot. Here we are. We've had the tightest Fed since Volcker, really. And yet gold is within $50 of its all-time high, or $100 of its all-time high, 4%. And Bitcoin is up 80% year to date. So this is how sound money assets perform when they're trying to save the system by raising interest rates. Wait until they're forced into flipping, which they inevitably will be, because they can't continue the path they're on without creating Great Depression 2.0. This stuff is just going to scream. So I'm pretty excited about that. And always accepting new investors into the fund. The minimum is 250, and that's because of the rules the SEC places on me. So gotcha. If people want to contact me, I'm at ema2.com.
What's the name of the fund, Larry?
It's called the EMA GARP Fund. It's a sound money theme: gold, silver, gold and silver miners, Bitcoin, and Bitcoin venture capital.
Awesome. Well,
Caitlin is prominently in there in the Bitcoin venture capital. I think she's our largest investment.
Well,
thank you for your confidence.
You guys are legends. Thank you so much for joining us on Simply Bitcoin IRL. Really appreciate it. This episode will come out on Saturday. Thank you guys so much, and appreciate you.
Yeah, it's always fun to be with you guys. Great job, Caitlin.
Likewise. Thank you. Thanks, Larry. Thanks, Nico.
See you.
Best wishes, guys. Bye.